You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and we're live every Wednesday at 11 a.m. from Roberta's in Bushwick on Heritage Radio Network. Our topic is taste. Each week we're meeting or chatting with tastemakers, tasters, people who think about food and the experience of enjoying it in unique and individual ways, whether they produce it, they write about it, they prepare it, they basically consume food. That would be everybody, but not everybody thinks about it in the same way. Thank you for joining me. Remember that you can call in on and ask questions at Heritage Radio Network by dialing 718-497-2128. And today, a special Happy New Year to all of our Jewish listeners. It's Rosh Hashanah, and in keeping with the theme of holidays and traditions, we thought our topic today would be traditional tastes. And I have two people, very excited to have two people with me in the studio, two people who think about food probably more than they think about anything else, maybe except for one thing, but that's a different show. We've got Adam Rappaport, the editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit magazine, an old friend and an old debater of traditional tastes in the Jewish idiom, joining us. We're really happy to have you here, Adam. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Mitch. Are we talking about good hair? Is that the other thing we're
yeah, that's thinking the other about? Thing. All right. Okay. Well, that's what you concerned you more than anything, probably. And also joining us is Ed Baer, the editor-in-chief, founder, publisher of The Art of Eating, a magazine for whom taste is really the organizing principle. So thank you for being here, Ed.
It's a pleasure.
And we are excited to be able to talk about your new cookbook, The Art of Eating Cookbook, which has as a theme unexpectedly traditional tastes and flavors. So I think we're, although perhaps the Jewish idiom isn't exactly your realm.
That's okay. I'm open.
Indeed. But let's start, Adam. Tell me a little bit about your new life at Bon Appetit magazine and being all consumed no longer with hair and fashion, but with taste.
I still have to get dressed every morning, so that's always a daily challenge. I spent 10 years at GQ as a style editor, so did a lot of fashion there, but also food as well, and took over the Bon Appetit job in December. We had our first sort of relaunch issue in May, and it's been great. It's been a lot of fun. You know, it's a job, so it's not without its headaches, but being able to make your own magazine is a pretty cool thing.
Of course. And what about the transition from thinking about fashion and the aesthetics of fashion to thinking about food in the magazine context?
What's that been like? You know, honestly, I think my job is kind of make a magazine. And that was a similar job as I had at GQ. And you think about balance. You think about making it graphically arresting and beautiful. You need voice. You need opinion. You want the articles to sort of jump off the page. And so whether you're writing about, you know, how to make chopped liver or brisket for Rosh Hashanah, or whether you're talking about how your tie should match the width of your lapels on your jacket, you're explaining content and you want to make it appealable and understanding to the reader. So that's kind of my challenge as an editor. The difference being that at GQ, you're hiring guys who know fashion. At Bon Appetit, you're hiring people who know food and restaurants and cooking. Like I said, I personally have interest in both those fields, but for me, the primary challenge is make a cool magazine.
Interesting. And so far you've succeeded in making a magazine cool.
No.
It's not a cool magazine. Ed, let's talk about magazines.
I'm thinking, I make a magazine too, but it's a completely different kind of magazine.
Talk about the magazine you make a little bit.
You know, it's not exactly totally opposite, and we do want to do the same things. You want that excitement. You want readers with writers with different voices. I don't go so far as to say I have articles jump off the page, but I like the idea. I mean, there's something about a magazine which I think will make it last longer than perhaps books, or at least on a larger scale for longer. And it's that physical experience. It's the page-turning experience. And but my magazine has no ads. And part of the...
What?
What? I know exactly.
What kind of magazine is it? And, what are you doing?
Well, you're completely right. I mean, it's like, I ask myself, what is a magazine without ads? Because a lot of that experience of page turning is the interaction between high quality production on the editorial side and high quality production on the advertising side. So if you have a magazine, you know, I think of...
It pops.
Yeah,
right?
Vogue, I don't know. Certain kinds of magazines really have really high production values for the ads, and then the ads are almost more exciting than the editorial, and it's really an exciting physical experience of turning the page and having those surprises. And so I, having just described that other thing, have an ad magazine with fewer pages than most normal magazines and no ads, and we still try and replicate some of that, but I think inevitably you have more calm.
Yeah, but I think what's interesting, you're talking about that the physical nature of print magazines, and we're at this point now in the publishing industry where we're expected to be producing, you know, monthly apps of the magazine and turning the magazine into a digital experience, which is a very different reading experience, and you're sliding it this way, you're vertically, horizontally, it's just a very different tactile experience, and with magazines, I think ultimately that goal is, you know, with Art of Eating, is that, you know, can you make something that people not only want to read but hold on to?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I remember back in the
physically
90s,
hold on to.
That, you know, when Saveur first launched, that was a magazine that I did not want to throw away. I mean, I still have like the first 2 or 3 years worth of issues, and
right.
It was a beautiful piece of work with just
Agree.
It was smart and had a point of view and photography. And I didn't want to throw it away. Whereas so much of the digital experience today is in your inbox 1 second, gone the next, and you enjoy it, and it's cool, it's fun, it's stimulating, but there's not that sort of perseverance to it.
Yeah. I mean, God willing, my magazine will, the people keep the copies, and it'll be around a long time, but we wrestle. We feel we are only print right now. And I feel we should be digital, and that the question is how on earth to go about it when you're, you know, you don't have American Express or Condé Nast behind you, and you want to do something that's very real and very, it's complimentary.
It shouldn't be the same thing. That's what we're all sort of grappling with. How do you, same with the Beard Foundation, like how you can exist in these different sort of media, whatever you call it, and offer a different experience, because I don't think it should just be the exact same thing.
No,
because then what's the point?
It can't be. And one is the page turning experience is much more linear, and then the app experience is just everywhere. And and for me, there's a lot of incoherence to that, and I want as a reader coherence, so I don't know how you achieve that, but hopefully it can be done.
Well, I said we'd talk about traditional taste, but we can talk about traditional publishing.
It's the publishing hour.
Well, there's a tradition. We're talking about the tradition of ink on paper.
Right. Well, we are talking about the future, so let's look at the past a little bit. It is a Jewish holiday today, and Ed, you have a new... This evening.
Yes.
Erev Rosh Hashanah.
Yes.
Thank you for correcting me.
Maybe
this today somewhere else in the world. I don't know. But you have a new cookbook out about traditional taste, and I want to talk about this idea of flavors of the past and memories of taste versus sort of the things that we enjoy today. And magazines might be one of those things. Magazines are ways to deliver these sort of fantasy experiences, these aspirational tastes, if you will. So let's look a little bit, like, what is the role of traditional taste in this world where all we want is new, flippy, zippy, trendy, here we are at Roberta's, what's the next thing? I mean, Ed?
Yeah, this is what I think about all the time, and it's, you present it to me all at once, it's almost a showstopper. I can't even find which word I should begin with. All the time we're eating modern food. To me, it's the norm. And there's little taste of things. And you get one bite, and that's just great. But, oh, that was only that one little one on the plate. And we go on to the next. And this is a little bit like the app. There's an incoherence to what's going on. Not always, not at its best. At its best, it's great. It's, you know, I would allow that the greatest modern cooking is art. But tradition, it's a whole bowl full. And these are flavors that you know go together. People would not have been cooking these over and over all this time if it didn't work.
See Italian food.
Right. We'll have a link on the on
the basil, tomatoes. Yes, this works.
Is there something natural? I mean, some of those things have been edited out over time. It's a little bit like if you look at the shelf of literature, a few of them will stick around. Tomato and basil stuck around. What everyone was eating, do we even know what anyone was eating historically?
Well, that's the... the troubled question, the fraught question is what's tradition, what's authentic, what were people eating at a particular point of time, how do you know? I think there is, I'm probably guilty of a little bit of fantasy. I kind of envision a time that, you know, well before digital, maybe before cars, but there's a moment when people had settled existences in the same place without, I don't know what, disruptions by the railroad even. You know, these are things that people did over and over in a settled life where there wasn't a lot of entertainment and food was much more a part of the happiness, the central happiness of every day. Mm. So food had a lot more to accomplish.
Interestingly, when you talk about the happiness of every day, let's talk about Jewish food, perhaps.
Wait, can I just jump in on that point you're making? Well, you know, I do think as an American culture, we are obsessed with the new, and certainly in cities like New York with the New York Magazine fall preview issue and Bon Appetit's mm-hmm. best new restaurants. But, you know, at the same token, I think while that kind of consumes us in that sort of digital way of what's cool right now, you know, people as eaters are always returning to the comfort. You know, it's like, has there been a cool restaurant in New York that didn't do a fried chicken special in the last 2 years? And during the recession, what was that one sort of restaurant sort of feel that did better than any other? Steakhouses. You know, people, it's like, if I'm going to go spend money, I want a good steak, I want hash browns, I want cream spinach. And so while we are consumed with the new, it's the old that we are constantly returning to, and that's what people always will want.
And let's explore that. That's a great point. Yesterday, we sat around a table discussing issues related to sustainability and agriculture and public health with a bunch of food people. And one of the chefs said, you know, every time I open the paper every day, it's the top 10 hamburgers, the top 10 hamburgers. And here we are in the middle of New York City, this place of cutting edge. We could argue that in another episode. Cuisine, people who want new, all that sort of stuff. So what do we, I mean, is it an emotional connection, or is there something platonic in the tastes and the things that are just visceral
I think it's visceral. I think it's visceral. Platonic. I think there are things that just belong together on a plate and they just want to be there. And I do think, yes, steakhouses, certain things, fried chicken, but it's those more confected dishes that we tend not, that maybe take either a little more time or they've just somehow fallen a little bit out of our consciousness that we tend not to reproduce so much.
Yeah, I think, but it's also, I think ultimately also it just comes down to that yin and yang relationship, is that you want both. You know, I was in Chicago this past weekend for this food festival, Chicago Gourmet, that Bon Appetit sponsored, and I ate at Blackbird restaurant on Saturday night, which is wonderful, and just flavors that you had no idea could ever go together. A cured egg yolk and salt and pepper with a pork chop. I mean, just crazy stuff, but it somehow worked, but every dish was kind of a challenge in a good way. Last night, I had a really great cheeseburger, you know, and it's like you go over here, then you want to come back over here, and you go back and forth to kind of, you want, you know, I've been to Mitchell's house a lot, fortunately, for dinner, and often, you know, you are doing some variation of really comforting home cooking, and yet you've also go out to eat at the most sort of avant-garde restaurants in the world. You know?
Right. Well, and there is that issue, you know, of context, I think, is what I hear you saying. It's a holiday. One of the things that always makes me laugh about the magazine world is every November there are pictures of turkey and 25 new recipes, whether they're new Mexican or they're, you know, Peruvian Thanksgiving, all this sort of stuff that you can do for Thanksgiving. But when the reality of making Thanksgiving dinners, everyone just wants the same thing. And in fact, if you want to make something new, you have to make all of the old things and one new thing.
True.
Because you don't want to disappoint anybody who's expecting that stuffing or your aunt's beans.
You just basically summarized the issue we just shipped 2 days ago for the November. Yeah, he's like, you know what? Everyone wants the new takes on Thanksgiving, but they also want, how do you make a basic, you know, gravy and mashed potatoes?
Right,
it's like,
exactly.
And you've got to hit all those notes, and it drives you a little bit insane.
I'd remind our listeners that you can call in if you have questions about publishing, about Thanksgiving, about Jewish food, about traditional tastes. We're talking with Adam Rappaport, editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit magazine, and Ed Baer, editor-in-chief, we'll just use the same title, of The Art of Eating, and the author of the new Art of Eating cookbook. So tonight is Rosh Hashanah, a holiday where most families are making the same things. And one of the interesting things about traditional tastes is they aren't always good. And I'm going to put myself out there and say that. And Jewish food is one of those cuisines that has been maligned by comedians in from Las Vegas to the Catskills for being horrible for various reasons, despite the fact that food is really an integral part of Jewish culture. And so I want to talk about these, like, who decides what traditions are good or ought to be preserved, and who doesn't, and how does, maybe it's just a factor of time, but I'm sitting here before I brought in, just to inspire our conversation, a little chopped liver and a little matzo ball soup because it's 11 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. Right? But you know, but every family has its own traditions, and you know, to be honest, they're not all created equal. I've had Mitchell's matzo ball soup. It's really, really good.
And I've had your mother's brisket, and it's now one of our family's traditions.
Yes, but I've had lots of matzo ball soup that it's a dense, hard matzo ball with watery broth. And, you know, I've had brisket that's kind of not cooked long enough. It's not as tender as it should be. It's just kind of bad mushroom. You know, so there's good and bad traditions in Jewish food.
So comfort, perhaps, and tradition are two different things.
What you're also talking about the quality of cooks.
Exactly. Right. Seriously. There's some great grandmothers, and there's some not-so-great grandmothers.
Right. And I've been on the record as saying not all grandmother's food is good, and yours probably isn't too. Which isn't to say anything against grandmothers. It's a time for us to take a break.
Can we eat?
Yes, please. Welcome back. You're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, and we're chatting about traditional tastes.
You're also listening to AC/DC.
You are also listening to AC/DC. Why are we listening to AC/DC, Mr. Rappaport?
Because you said I can request a fade-in song or lead-in song, and, well, this is just such an obvious one. And it's just kind of one of those songs that just it just works, and Bon Scott's doing his bagpipe solo right there.
There you go. I believe you told me it was just the greatest song ever recorded.
Kind of,
like
just
that.
It's a natural. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that selection. We, in the 3 weeks we've been on the air, and for the many years to come, we are going to have an eclectic mix of music, I would say, given, let's see, we've had Public Enemy, we have Pizzicato 5, we've got AC/DC.
That's great.
Yeah, I think it's great. Somehow stimulating a different sense from the senses on our tongue. We are here at Taste Matters. You can call in at 718-497-2128. We are enjoying some untraditional chopped liver, some matzo ball soup.
And who made these things?
I made these things. Who made these things?
I knew that, but yes. I wanted to get credit and confirm.
No offense to my mom, Maxine, who makes a damn good matzo ball soup. But I would say Mitchell makes the best matzo ball soup that I've ever tasted. Although, Mitchell, this broth, not quite as good as the one you made in my house one time with, I think you had a stewing hen or something, or an older bird.
It's true. And there you go. See, the man knows his food, because there was no stewing hen in this broth. I actually had to put it together from pieces of chicken because I didn't have a lot of time.
But explain to the novice cook what a stewing hen does for broth.
A stewing hen is an old bird, and an old bird isn't really good to eat fresh or roasted or in some gently prepared way. But if you're going to cook something for 3 or 4 hours, you want a tough old bird to give all of its flavor up to the sauce. I happen to love the meat that comes from that, and I'm straining the soup and half pulling it off and eating it as it goes on. It's kind of gross, but I love it. But I mean, they're not pretty. They're old stewing
hens. They're old bags, but it makes a nice sort of deep amber gold. I mean, it's a beautiful looking.
This does, however, have the feet in it. Chicken feet are key, and I always have some in the freezer just in case.
Do you get them from Chinatown, or where do you get them from?
You can get them in other places and from butchers. Every chicken comes with 2 feet. It's surprising. You know?
What a bargain.
Yeah, some come with 3. I think I've heard at factory chicken farms,
exactly.
But that's different. But so we have, there are flavor, I think, and traditional flavors come in combinations of sets of flavor. We think of tomato and basil, we've talked about, and mozzarella, for instance, as a combination. We think of onions and
everything.
Fat. We think of
onions and everything.
Onions and everything, of course. We think of soy sauce and ginger and garlic, and we think of Chinese. Is there something about, we mentioned earlier, things just go together on the plate. How? Why? Like, is it geography? I know we're guessing here, but what puts them together?
Well, I think often, but not always, sometimes they come from far away, but often they come from the same place. People have been eating them together for a long time. You know, a certain, I don't know, bread evolves in a certain way, a cheese evolves in a certain way. Often it goes with the wine, though that's probably overstated.
What's overstated?
That the wine of the place goes with the cheese.
Yeah, because sommeliers will always tell you that this wine from this soil and it's flinty and this and that goes with the lamb that grazes on the. I think it's a naturalistic affectation to me.
To the extent that it's true to me, logically it would be true because the guy making the cheese is drinking the wine, so the cheese drifts off a little bit in the direction that it goes better with the wine. You know,
in terms of developing. I mean, if you look at Italian food in the southern parts of Italy, those ingredients like the capers and tomatoes and olives and do they go together because they're grown together? Maybe. They also maybe go together because for thousands of years people have been toying with those ingredients and finding out which ones work best together, you know?
That would be my guess.
Yeah.
Except that in the case of tomatoes, of course, they were a late arrival and have become more marked as Italian than perhaps anything, even though they've only been consumed in the last 150 years.
And then there are, I hate to quote a bad TV commercial, but, you know, your peanut butter is in my chocolate. And just certain things like, you know what? Peanut butter and chocolate go together really, really well. And I don't think peanut butter is from South America, but, you know, chocolate is from there. Mexico? Where's chocolate from originally?
Central America.
Central America, yeah.
But then there are things that people love together, like orange and chocolate, and that other people hate, or apples and celery.
I hate orange and chocolate.
There you go. Apples and celery yesterday we were served, and Ed was like, I don't think these go together naturally.
Well, no, I know that other people like them, but for me it's that Waldorf salad taste in all my life. It just hasn't spoken to me, and I will eat almost anything, except actually peanut butter and chocolate.
Wow.
We've hit like the two things that I don't eat, but I think everyone has has their idiosyncrasies.
They do. What are your idiosyncrasies then?
I hate caviar.
Really?
I don't want to say I'm a sissy eater because that might be overstating it, but I am not, full disclosure, as an adventurous of an eater as I'd like to be.
Is this a textural thing or just?
As a kid, it was. You know, yeah. I hated like bananas because they were mushy. Yeah. Although we have a banana haters club.
Really?
Me, Adam Sachs, wonderful food writer. Danielle Ballou is also in it.
Sia Glover, a former employee at our office.
Apparently, Martha Stewart, also banana hater. And we had Brett Martin, one of our other fellow food writer friends, but he defected. And all of a sudden, a couple years ago, he started liking bananas for some reason.
I think you've just explained the popularity of the glycemic index diet, which prohibits bananas because they spike your insulin or your blood sugar, apparently. And it seems counterintuitive since we are primates originally, and primates eat lots of bananas.
Which is good if you're playing sports, though, no? You always see like golfers and stuff eating bananas in the middle when they need energy. Yeah.
They need the jolt.
But bananas, I'm not a big fishy guy. I like a cleaner sort of simple seafood, but I don't like really fishy fish.
Which would lead me to our conversation yesterday about, I just got back from eating in Sweden and Denmark, and in Sweden, several chefs are on a kick of aging their fish before they serve it, up to 14 days.
Like steak, you mean?
Like steak.
That's crazy.
For the same reason, the breakdown of protein into glutamic acids.
Which raises the big question, why doesn't it taste fishy? But you say it doesn't.
Well, they claim because they're killed in this Japanese technique called Ikejima, and they remove whatever bacteria.
Is that where the fish kill themselves with the samurai sword?
Yeah, that is the technique. It's very hard to get them to do it. No, it is where they insert something through the spine after the fish is killed right on the boat, and it forces out some microbial whatever that might lead to the putrefaction that we associate with old fish. All of it's new to me and completely.
And is it new to them too, relatively?
Yes, and just a handful of them are starting to work on it. But this idea of it made me think of, we were being brought around by a Swedish food enthusiast who hates this fermented Norwegian herring, which it's awful, it's disgusting, it tastes like garbage, it's shit, whatever, yet it was sold everywhere because it's a delicacy in Norway. And there are some things that just are unique to a place, some flavors that just do not translate for whatever reasons, because of their...
Provençal olive oil, you know, to me...
Say more?
Well, it's the traditional oil, basically, of all around the Mediterranean, but if you don't have powerful high technology, you have presses that don't press so hard, you need really ripe olives. And what they used to do, especially in Provence, was not just pick the olives really ripe, then they would store them and they would start some sort of fermentation. It's a taste called in French chaumé. Mm-hmm. And that is the traditional taste, that it's a taste. It is not, and the scientists who deal with this insist, and the people who produce it and have an economic stake insist, it is not rancid. It tastes, to the rest of us, rancid.
It tastes rancid.
But I would say, if I'm in Provence eating Provençal food, the cooked food, not so much maybe a salad, I kind of think that taste all goes together. And if you read Jean Giono or whatever, you know, these encomiums to this particular taste. But it's a deeper, earthier, right. I don't know, one of a more
so
masculine taste.
Not all traditional flavors or tastes are coming out of some idea of connoisseurship, or some of them come out of hardship, in fact. Some of them come out of limited technology, or limited access.
I mean, I remember being in Sicily talking with a Sicilian producer of olive oil, and he's at the beginning of the harvest when he was young, there would be this incredible oil, like the best oil we get today. And he would say to his father, "Dad, why don't we have oil like this all the time?" Well, you could only get it at the beginning of the harvest when these were the least overripe olives. They were all the equipment was clean, all the mats, everything right. They used for the pressing, everything was clean. But they couldn't keep that up. I mean,
right, just then in that moment.
That was
right.
That, and they had a little bit of great oil, but that's the oil that set the standard for all our present connoisseurship.
And then so you find an aspect that people like for whatever reason, because it's cleaner, fresher, less difficult to...
Well, it's more flattering to me. It's more that fresh fruit-tasting olive oil is much more flattering to the greens and things we do with it. It's more delicate. It's a more modern taste, you could argue.
Right.
And so I'm... Now
which
I'm
I would argue my chopped liver is a more modern taste, even though it has a traditional flavor, because of a secret ingredient. And I'll give you extra bonus points if you can guess what's in it. And... I'll give you a hint. Lightning might come through the studio if it...
Bacon.
Indeed, it's made with bacon.
Oh, my God.
Ed Baer, the washed non-Jew, catches this. Thank you. The studio audience is
oh, see, I mean, I assume like with calf's liver, it's always served with bacon and onions, right?
Indeed. And I didn't have much schmaltz. Actually, it's made with Provençal Perigordine goose fat and bacon, and it's pretty tasty, it turns out.
Yeah, it's funny. I was talking to my young assistant, Rachel Sanders, yesterday, and we were talking about Rosh Hashanah recipes, and I was talking about the chopped liver that I make based on the one that my mom makes. And, you know, I said the secret to great chopped chicken liver is not a lot of chicken liver. And it's like you need a lot of caramelized onions, a lot of chopped hard-boiled eggs.
A lot of mustard.
I'll add mustard, dried mustard, and a lot of horseradish. And it's getting... Because liver itself is a pretty aggressive flavor. And you need a lot of sort of balance and sort of ingredients to sort of sweeten it. And then it can be great. But if it's a very livery liver, that's going to only appeal to a pretty small audience.
And there's definitely... We were talking earlier on that theme that we're in a moment right now where people are fetishizing sort of peasant, aggressive... tastes or aggressive eating experiences, aggressively rustic. I just came, as I said, from Sweden, and we ate a raw moose heart and marrow from a femur sod in the dining room, like we were, you know, playing the Flintstones or something. It was really like that at a beautiful restaurant that is soon to be regarded as one of the greatest in the world.
Which, and I think we wrote about in the last
issue.
Did,
in fact,
yeah. Bon Appetit.
Fäviken, and 600 miles north of Stockholm. And you couldn't help but laugh at the fact that if we were hunter-gatherers back when, this might be what we were enjoying, and here we were enjoying it again. Is there something about the playing in these flavors and these dishes?
Well, I think that one of the most exciting things, and maybe we've revived so many of these tastes now, it's no longer so special, but do you feel like you feel like you have the taste of history in your mouth?
Yes.
I think that's very, very exciting. And I think
I love
a lot
that
of it,
concept of the taste of history. I think the Japanese use that a lot. I think the Japanese taste history in a certain way. Like it's one of the flavors.
But it's interesting, though, that, you know, like I said, if you grew up in Scandinavia, your taste buds are sort of acclimated to lots of fish or cured fishes or, you know, smoked. And it's like, it's part of your culture. But you know, if I grew up in Mexico, or when you and I went to Mexico City ages ago, and you get a lot of porkiness there. And this is not like Berkshire.
It's not like bacon in the chopped liver.
Yeah, nor is it like Berkshire pork from upstate New York with delicate trims of fat. I mean, this is like hardcore pork. You know, it's just strange if you...
It's probably pork from uncastrated boars.
Yeah, it's hardcore. I just think it's like to taste these sort of experiences like a favican, like it's coming completely out of the blue to a taste buds that are not used to it. So it is different if you're from that culture. You've grown up with that food. And to all of a sudden thrust yourself in here, it's much more of a novelty thing. And I don't know if people are pretending they like it or just eating it out of curiosity, but you're not... Your taste buds aren't sort of honed or trained to actually know what to do with that food.
I think that's true. And I mean, just to contradict you slightly, we asked a lot of Swedish people if what we were experiencing was something they had a reference for, and none of them. They thought we were out of our minds.
Oh, wow.
In all honesty, I mean, not that everything we ate wasn't coming from in that area, but Sweden, as all countries in the world, have gone through this process of progress, of industrialization, of commercialization, of globalization that has changed tastes, these traditional things. Perhaps even highlighting these traditional things somewhat. We are just about out of time, and it's a shame because, like every week, it feels like we could talk forever. I don't know if people listening at home would like us to do that, but certainly we'd like to sit here at Roberta's and talk forever. We'll be back next week, actually, Wednesday at 11 a.m., and we'll be talking with Laurent Gras, who will be talking about chef's tastes. One of the things that fascinates me always is I almost always disagree with the restaurant picks of the chefs I love, and I'm trying to get at this idea of what they are experiencing when they eat out versus what those of us normal food enthusiasts experience when we eat out. So Laurent Gras, Michelin 3-star chef, will be here in Brooklyn with us. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Ed. You're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis, and we'll hear you next week. We'll see you next week. Listen to you next week. We'll do something next week together.
See ya.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
The Heritage Meat Shop has just opened in the Essex Street Market. Open from 9 to 7 Monday through Saturday and 10 to 6 on Sundays, the Heritage Meat Shop supports independent family farms and animal welfare approved and certified humane raising standards. Most importantly, they offer a wide variety of heritage breeds. So stop by, get a sandwich, try the charcuterie. The Heritage Meat Shop at the Essex Street Market.